Earth, Wind, and Water, June to September 1905. That was how our correspondence began with the Wrights. Orville seemed to handle all their letter writing. He wrote impersonal letters, not because he was not a friendly man, but because he was the kind of man who did not often display his own inner emotions. He answered any of Father's questions readily enough, and his answers were always prompt. At that time, few of their fellow demons believed that the Wrights had really flown. Most demons thought that the Wrights were humbugs. It was not until a few years later, when they flew their flying machine in another demon land, France, I think, that demons accepted flight as a fact. After Father got the first letter, he began to make larger glider models. They were mock-ups of the actual aeroplane, with wingspans of up to 5 feet. There were extra strings that led to the various rudders. The idea was to let Father see for himself how the aeroplane flew. Short of going to the Wrights and letting them teach us on their actual flying machine, it was the only way of learning how to fly. Robin was all excited by the mock-up gliders my father built. "How does it fly?" she demanded of the latest model.
"Like dream," I said. "You ought to see it ride winds, like cloud."
"Yes, we should see it," Robin said firmly. "We'll have a picnic at the beach. We haven't had one in just ages."
"What about your aunt?" I asked.
"You leave my aunt to me," Robin said firmly.
"What about your father?"
"You leave him to me," I said.
That Saturday, we went on a picnic. The morning of Saturday, Father glanced at himself in the mirror.
"I can't go out like that."
On impulse, he searched through our trunk and took out a long red silk ribbon. "What's that?" I asked.
"Your mother gave me this ribbon," Father said almost shyly, "the first year we were married."
He dangled the ribbon.
"She said it was to be my formal suit of clothes."
He unbound his queue until his hair hung down loose on his back. Then he recombed it and rebraided the queue, intertwining the red ribbon through the braids. The red ribbon did make his hair look quite colorful, a little like the red lining around the scales of a black snake. Miss Whitlaw came out fresh and pert as a young girl on her first date. She wore the large kind of broad-brimmed hat that women wore in those days, which she tied down with a scarf that she had knotted underneath her chin. She had on a kind of little jacket over her blouse. Under her arm was a straw hamper.
"I can't wait to see what you brought for our lunch," she said.
"Neither can I," Father said, and explained that he had left all the buying up to me.
We caught the streetcar to the park and part of the way toward Ocean Beach in the west. We walked along the sand dunes that seemed to stretch endlessly away on either side. To the north, we could hear the barking of seals from where they basked on Seal Rock. Robin and I went wading in the water, splashing one another. Then we had lunch. Miss Whitlaw had provided thick sandwiches with meat from a fat bird which the demons liked. A turkey, I think it was called. Inside the sandwiches, she had added slices of cranberry sauce as well as bread stuffing. I was barely able to get my mouth around one of them. There was also fresh lemonade, ginger snaps, and fresh fruit, and nuts which we cracked between rocks. At the same time, I had brought along large meat-filled dumplings and other smaller pastries filled with various kinds of ground meat and shrimp. All of these I had bought in the Tong people's town that morning. There was tea, of course. After that was over, Father lay on his back, patting his stomach.
"I feel badly in need of some exercise," he said.
"Do you want to fly the glider?"
"I think it's time."
I turned to the others and told them.
"I get to hold the string,"
Robin said in a rush of words.
"No," I protested. "I do." "But I said it first,"
Robin turned to her aunt.
"Didn't I, Auntie?"
"Now, Robin, it isn't ladylike to run,"
Miss Whitlaw cautioned.
"But ladies first," Father said. "Then Moonshadow."
"Oh, all right," I said sullenly. "But I get hold it." "Go on for all I care."
Robin had already begun to unbutton her shoes. In those days, children wore heavy, practical shoes that felt like they would outlast a steel monument, so whenever you could go barefoot, you appreciated it. Robin picked up the roll of string while I picked up the glider.
"Let's go over here," Robin said.
"Why?"
"Because I want to."
I muttered something that she pretended to ignore. I followed her obediently over to where the sand dunes dropped sharply 5 or 6 feet to the beach itself. We had picnicked above the beach among the sand dunes, almost on a kind of plateau. She looked down the almost perpendicular slope. "Ready?" she asked over her shoulder. "Yes."
"Here I go," Robin shouted as she plunged down the dune, her legs lost in a cloud of sand.
Half stumbling, she raced down the dry stretch of sand to the darker sand where the sea still rolled in and out. Her straw sailor hat flew off.
"Robin!"
Miss Whitlaw shouted. But Robin was already 100 feet away now, standing ankle-deep in the surf. The line was already taut.
"Let go," Father said.
I did, and the glider leaped out of my hands, 3 feet into the air, and hovered indecisively. Robin ran parallel to the surf line, her pigtails flying. The glider was one of Father's earlier models, without the rudder controls. It was really like a big box kite in some ways. Suddenly, the sea winds caught the glider and lifted it upward toward the sun, veering and soaring like a thing alive, pulling stubbornly at the string. Robin had stopped way down on the beach, a solitary little figure with the waves washing her legs. Father cupped his hands about his mouth.
"Give it more string," he shouted to her. "Give it more string. It smells its home."
And Robin did. She had to, or it would have been lost. Father went down to fetch her hat. That long afternoon, we took turns flying the glider. First Robin, then me, then even Miss Whitlaw.
"Flying is a rather exhilarating experience," she confessed to us.
Her eyes were shining as a twist of her wrist sent the glider dipping and then rising. By the end of the day, it was Father's turn. I remember how he stood on the beach, his pants rolled up as he high-stepped, whooping and shouting through the surf. Once he stumbled and went down in the water, but he came right back up, laughing and spluttering and spitting out seawater. Triumphantly, he held up the string to show us he had held on to the glider. The sunset was beautiful that day. The sun was a bright orange disk hovering over the sea, and the sunlight glittered on the surface like a web of light or lace that ever changed its pattern. Clouds were coming in from the ocean now, and they were tinted a bright scarlet red as they bordered the sun, but the farther away they got, the more they showed a deep, solemn purple, and beyond that purple, it was black. And in some patches you could see the stars, but I like to think that they were not stars, but the eyes of dragons watching us from above. By now it was Robin's turn again with the glider. But first, before he had let her take it up, Father had brought out a long red strip of paper. Last night I had seen him copy out the poem from the strip Lefty had given him, but he would not tell me why. Father attached the poem to the glider like a tail. It was only then that he would let Robin take it up.
"Are the sunsets like this in China?" Miss Whitlaw asked.
"Yes, just as lovely. Must be lovely all round world."
We sat in silence at the thought of that, feeling suddenly peaceful and happy. But finally, Miss Whitlaw looked at her father's old watch, which she had brought in the hamper.
"I do think it's time to be heading back."
"Yes, I think so too," Father said quietly.
But he did not go for his boots or roll his trousers back down. Instead, he took the string from the astonished Robin. With one hand he held the string, and with the other he dipped into his pants pocket and pulled out his penknife. He put the string between his teeth and unfolded the blade. For one moment, he watched, satisfied, as the glider tugged at the string in his hand and the poem fluttered. Then, with a sudden sweep, he cut the cord.
"Mr. Lee!" Miss Whitlaw said in horror.
"We make more," Father said. "What I make one day, I do again."
And I knew he was thinking of more than just making glider models. The glider shot upward, trailing the line behind it. It hovered for a moment like a seabird waiting for the great sea winds to catch it up so it could range long distances, perhaps all the way to the Middle Kingdom. Then the winds took it and swept it upward toward the west, and it was gone. Father calmly folded his knife.
"It better not hold on to it. He added in the typical way of a Tong person. It bad glider anyway.
Robin stared up at Father like he was crazy.
It was a beautiful glider.
You like one?
Father asked. That won Robin over completely.
You bet, she said.
Robin, Miss Whitlaw snapped.
Really, Mr. Lee, I don't know what's gotten into that greedy child.
Father held up his hand.
I take as compliment.
He turned to Robin.
I make one for Moonshadow, one for you, and one for your aunt, he said.
Robin looked up wistfully at the empty sky.
But we have no glider now.
There be other days, I said.
And there were. And there were other things we did, too, like going for evening rides on the cable car to get away from the heat. We rode on the outside so the breezes would cool us off. During this time, we were not completely cut off from the Tong people's town. Once a week, with my empty basket on my arm, I would walk the block down to the cable car line and ride a cable car over the steep hills into the Tong people's town. I could have walked that distance, but it was too risky when I was by myself. Once I was in the town, I would bring our letters and money to the headquarters of our district association so they could be sent home. Then I would pick up what letters had arrived and do some grocery shopping. By the time I had caught the cable car back to Polk Street, my basket would be weighed down. It was not until late July that we received a reply from Mother and Grandmother to the letter Father had written them in May. Grandmother's letter was full of anxious advice, but her chief warning was to boil any water before we drank it. The demon's water, she informed us, was not very safe. Mother offered more advice and added that Father had been lucky that the man he had killed had had no close kinsmen, for that sort of thing had led to feuds in the past. Mother also said that she offered incense to the listener as often as she could, asking the listener to watch over us among the demons. Father was pretty sure they would be comforted by the letters we had written during the last 2 months, for they were full of our successes among the demons, and especially about our new friends. But then came one Sunday in August. Father had to go to one of Mr. Alger's houses to fix some pipes that had just broken, so that left us without anything to do. But he had already made smaller glider models for the three of us.
Why don't we go fly them? Robin asked.
I don't know, I said. I was reluctant to leave the house without Father because of the demon boys. I could hear them playing in the street outside.
Oh, come on! I know an empty lot near here. It's real big and no trees, and it has some great winds.
No, I'd rather stay here.
Suit yourself, Robin said, 'cause I'm going.
I started to fix dinner to occupy myself. Robin came out with her glider under one arm. She stopped when she saw what I was doing. She always asked about everything I did when I made dinner. I think secretly she was hoping to catch me making a dish of dog's or cat's meat. But that day, I was preparing squid.
Ew, what's that? She made a face.
Squid. Can't you tell? I held up a bunch of tentacles about an inch long. She took one and examined it with interest.
Do you eat them like spaghetti?
She asked. I held up one 3-inch tentacle.
No, too small.
She made a face. She was not afraid of frogs or snakes or the other things that demon girls were supposed to be afraid of. I approved of that. Coming from a farming family where everyone, including the women, worked beside the men in the fields, we were not afraid of mice or frogs. You might be more annoyed with them for the damage they did or the noise they made.
Afraid?
Of course not, she snapped.
You sure you don't want to go fly my glider with me?
No. Robin stood on the steps. She heard the shrill voices of the boys, and suddenly she nodded her head as if she understood. I did not want to be patronized.
Well, why don't you go fly your glider?
I demanded.
Oh, I don't know, she said airily. It's a little late to do it. I guess I should get dinner ready, too.
She kicked me lightly.
Curse you for being a good influence on me.
She went back inside and came out a few minutes later with a pan of peas to be shelled. She had taken off her coat and had put away her glider. She watched as I finished cutting up the little squids and cleaning out the entrails that had become black with its ink.
"Ugh, that's disgusting," she said.
She sat down beside me and put the pan on her lap. She set down a pot next to her. "I'm not scared, mind you, just disgusted."
"Sure," I said.
She broke the pods with crisp snapping sounds. "But I will own up to being scared of thunder.
Lot of people scared."
She went on breaking pea pods into the pot.
"But now you take that Jack," she said. "You know him? He's the boy with the brown hair and the freckles. Well, he's the biggest boy in our school, and yet I happen to know personally from Maisie, his sister, that he'd rather die than let anyone know he was afraid of being hit in the nose, because he's scared of the sight of blood, especially his."
She studied me for a moment. She and I both knew the dragonish thing to do. Then she went back to shelling the peas. Outside, in front of the house, I could hear the voices of Jack and his gang. I began to shell peas for a while. Robin and I both knew I did not walk on Polk Street much because of the demon boys. Suddenly, I put the last peas into the pot and got up. Robin raised her eyebrows.
"Going for a walk?" "A little one," I said.
Jack immediately stopped playing mumblety-peg when he saw me. He took his penknife and drove it point first into the dirt of the alley. He got up with a big grin, and he and his friends gathered by the alley.
"Ching chong," he began. "I know like that song," I said.
"Too bad," Jack said. "I think it's stupid."
"You saying I'm stupid?
Everyone know that."
Jack charged me with a shout. His friends behind him began to yell with shrill, excited voices. I am not much of a fighter, and I never will be. There was as much luck with me that day as anything else. I was smaller and maybe quicker, but with his long arms and his strength, Jack could have strung me from a lamppost. But Grandfather and the other old ones must have been there to help me at that moment. Jack expected me to run, probably. He never expected me to stand up and fight, and he did not even think of dodging. I swung out, and my fist went right into his face. Jack sat down with a plop in the dirt, blood running down from his nose.
You hit me,
he said in surprise.
What you expect?
I asked. I doubted if I would ever get such a lucky punch in again. Still, I had come out here for the satisfaction of giving one punch to Jack for all the times he had tormented me, even if it meant getting beaten up in the end. I put up my fists awkwardly, ready to fight him some more. But Jack did not get up. The other boys behind him had grown silent.
"It's bleeding, too," Jack said, holding up a hand to his face. "And my mom just cleaned this shirt. She'll kill me."
"Tough." I just wanted to get the rest of the beating over with by that time. I held my fists ready to hit him.
"Jesus, but you're a scrappy little son of a..."
It sounded like, "Bitcha, aren't you?" Jack muttered.
"Bitcha?"
I said the word I didn't recognize.
"Shh," Jack said. "Not so loud, or we'll get our mouths washed out with laundry soap."
He held out his bloody hand. I took it and helped pull him up. Suddenly, I realized that these demons were like the Tong boys I knew at home. You only had to punch out the biggest and toughest of the bunch, and the others would accept you. Well, Jack was the biggest and toughest of his group. He looked down at me.
"Say, you know, you're all right, China boy," he said.
"I'm not China boy," I said.
"Whatever you say," he said.
And I knew I would not have to worry about wearing Handclap's charm after that. I don't mean to sound like all my problems with the demons were solved, or that I stopped wearing the charm completely. There was only one particular group of demon boys I did not have to watch out for. I still had to be careful whenever I left the stable. It's just that I was sure now that I could handle anything I met. My fists and my brains and my feet were as good a set of charms as the charm from Handclap. Sometimes the month of September in the Demon City could be just as hot as August. And it was on one such evening that we went out into the backyard because the house and stable had not cooled off as fast as the outside. We sat in chairs that we brought out. Robin, who knew something of the stars, began to name the constellations for us.
See that Milky Streak there? That's the Milky Way. And on one side, you see Aquila. That's Latin for eagle. And on the other side, you see Lyra, the lyre. That's a kind of harp.
That constellation you call Eagle. What you call that star?
Father pointed to the brightest star.
Altair.
And bright star of Lyre?
Vega.
Well, if you take those three stars of your eagle and forget about others, you get what we call the cowherd. And if you take those three stars of Lyre and forget about other stars, you get,
Father turned to me,
what you call it?
Spinning maid,
I said.
Just so, Father said.
And he went on to tell their story. How long ago, an angel who kept a herd of cows in the sky married an earth girl, the spinning maid, and took her to live with him in heaven. They spent so much time together that they did not do their work. The cows wandered all over heaven, and cloth did not get woven. The untended cows trampled into the palaces of the gods, and the gods themselves began to wear tattered robes because there was no cloth from which to make new ones. Finally, the Jade Emperor decided that the situation was impossible.
"We must separate the two," he said.
And his wife, taking a hairpin from her hair, dug a great ditch across the sky and created a river filled with a silvery white liquid, which Robin called the Milky Way, but which we call the Silver River. The two lovers wept so much that the Jade Emperor took pity on them and told them that on the seventh day of the seventh month they could visit one another. And on that night, all the magpies of the world gather together at the river and form a bridge, their wings interlaced, and they stay there, even though the passing lovers wear the feathers off their heads and wings.
Oh, but that's such a sad story,
Robin said.
Yes, it is, Father said.
But I saw he was looking up at the Silver River and thinking not of the story, but of Mother and himself. Only between them, no magpies formed a bridge across the oceans. Miss Whitlaw realized that too, I think, and so she changed the subject.
So tell me, Mr. Lee, if we took our constellations and broke them up into bits, and then reassembled them using the pieces of the different constellations, we would get the Chinese constellations?
Yes, Father said.
We see the same thing, and yet find different truths,
Miss Whitlaw mused. She pointed up at another group of stars.
What do you call that, Robin?
The twins,
she said.
I turned to Father.
And what you call that?
And Father perked up as he showed the Whitlaws how to realign them into another shape and told the story of that. Miss Whitlaw encouraged Father for a bit longer, until he and Robin began naming constellations and then rearranged the stars into other shapes. I looked at Miss Whitlaw. She winked at me. She had distracted Father.